Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Well, my second guest today has received many accolades and awards for her writing over the years. At 88 years young, you think she might kick back and take things a little easy, but you'd be very wrong on that. Pulitzer Prize winner Alison Lurie joins us to end today's show to discuss her latest book, just released from HarperCollins. It's called The Language of Houses, How Buildings Speak to Us. But first of all, we're going to talk about human relationships, not just the house, the housing relationships. We're going to talk about, you know how we all know that first love, that first giddy feeling that all too often fades all too quickly. So veteran couples therapist Linda Carroll is going to join me to share her views on the five natural stages of romantic relationships. Let me tell you a little bit about Linda. She is the author of Love Cycles, a couples therapist for over 30 years. She's certified in transpersonal psychology and imago therapy, and she's a master teacher in pairs therapy. She lives in Corvallis, Oregon, so she's fairly local to us. She offers workshops across the country and is a frequent speaker at Rancho La Puerta in Tecate, Mexico. And you can find out more about her at lindacarroll.com. But her book, again, is called Love Cycles, The Five Essential Stages of Lasting Love. Linda Carroll, welcome.
Well, hi, Vicki. Thanks so much for having me on the program.
I'm very pleased to have you here with us. You've been a therapist for many, many years. I'm curious about what drove you to couples therapy in particular.
Well, that's a great question. I think that when I started out 35 years ago, I took a class in relationships, and at the program I was in, and I went on to work with couples, and everything I did was wrong, and it was discouraging, and I thought, well, it's not good for me. The couples therapy is not good for me to practice. I'm just not good at it. Well, now 35 years later, what we know is that the things that I learned in school about how to work with couples, those were wrong too, and that's why it didn't work. So my husband and I got into couples therapy for ourselves and had a very deep commitment, but two very strong-willed people having a hard time learning to collaborate, and we began to learn things. We also got into psychoeducation, which was just starting about 25 years ago, which was the idea that you can teach skills to couples, and that rather than go to work on an issue with a therapist, if you learn the actual skills yourself, it's like giving a person a fishing rod rather than a fish.
Makes sense. We loved
the fishing rod. We loved the skills. I was so excited that there were actual skills that we could do that would help our relationship, that I had a bunch of clients I was seeing that had wanted me to see them and their partner. I thought, well, maybe I'm getting better at this. But actually, it wasn't that. It was that I was learning some things that were based on true research about how couples work rather than the old ideas about how people were. So it was really successful, and I just started training in different programs and creating my own course eventually. So that's how it began.
Very good. And I said that you studied imago therapy. I think I may have said that wrong. I do remember we had Dr. Harville Hendricks and his lovely wife, Helen Hunt, on the show a while ago.
Yes.
So how do we say that?
Imago.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
And so you specialized in this and pairs therapy. What's different about pairs therapy?
Well, they're both psychoeducation programs. The Paris Couples Course, which is an international couples course, really has, it's a whole toolbox from many different ways and many different people. And Harville Hendricks' work really is developed out of he and Helen's own laboratory and the fabulous imago therapists that are all now a part of it. And it's really based on learning how to listen in a different way than we usually listen, how we can cross the bridge into our partner's world and see life as they see it. You know, I have in Love Cycles, in my book, one of the things I talk about in many ways in that book is that I think there's one fight couples have over and over, and it's called the You're Not Me fight.
Right.
And it really is, it's like, you know, the great success of The Languages of Love, Gary Chapman's work, is really about that, because we think our partner is us. And so, for an example, when I'm sick, I like a lot of pity. I like a lot of attention. I like my husband to sit by my bed and say I'm okay, and what can he bring me, and fuss. When he's sick, he likes a glass of orange juice, the lights down, and to be left alone. So for years, guess what we did? When I got sick, he would bring me a glass of orange juice, put the lights down, and leave me
right,
alone.
Right.
I, of course, felt totally abandoned. Whereas when he would get sick, I'd fluff the pillows and say, oh, sweetie, you're okay. You know, what can I do? And he would just feel smothered. And finally, we started to get it. You're not me. And so the imago, part of the listening of imago in many programs, and I'm an imago therapist, and I do love that process, but it's also bigger than that how do we learn to really listen to another person, not through our own eyes or lens of how we see the world, but to understand how they see the world. And when you learn to do it, it changes everything. Not only when you learn how to listen to your partner or other people, but when you actually feel heard. You know, it's amazing to me how often couples that I work with or in my own relationship where someone feels so charged about an issue and their partner turns around and says, I really get why you're upset. And the whole issue dissolves in front of your eyes, because mostly what we want is we want to feel understood. We want to feel seen by the other person.
Right,
imago
right.
therapy is brilliant at helping people do that, among many other things that it does.
Yeah, well, I think we used to hold on to that old saying, you know, do unto others as you want done to yourself. But that obviously doesn't work. It's, we have to do unto others as they want done to themselves.
Vicki, that's exactly right. I'm just writing an article about that, because that's a tricky quote, isn't it? You know, I think that the heart of that quote really is about extension of ourselves, which we want other people to extend to us. You know, let me tell you an interesting piece of research. The University of Virginia a few years ago was looking into what was the most important quality in a relationship. And again, there's a whole piece of this in Love Cycles about the importance of this. And they thought it would be sex. They thought that it would be absence of conflict or even communication skills, all kinds of things. But no, what they found was it was generosity. The number one quality in a long-term relationship is learning to be generous. And I think that that's part of being able to see the other person, that they're not us. It comes from a generous spirit.
Right.
You know,
right.
I don't understand why you need that or why that's important to you, but I'm going to honor it, even though I think it's sort of crazy.
Right. Right. And since you brought up sex as being, you know, a lot of people do think that's one of the most important issues in a relationship. What's your view on that?
What's my view on sex? I think that I want to backtrack. It's a complicated question. This is what I think is most important, is that there's a conversation that's ongoing. You know, I think sex is a hugely important issue, and it's a fabulous gift that we have and that we can share and that we can get. But I think that more important is that there is a conversation. You know, I think couples have so much trouble talking about it. And if you're in a relationship that lasts past the merge, which is my first stage of love, where everything is free, generosity is free and good sex is free, and you don't have to work for anything, you're just madly in love with the other person and they with you. When you get past that and you get into a long-term relationship, I think your sexual life goes through many stages. You know, relationships are seasonal, and we have one of the reasons I wrote the book is that I wanted people to understand that the idea of of trouble in a relationship is normal, in the same way that sex sometimes we go in and out of feeling sexually alive, sexually, our passion, our testosterone, which we all have, our libido goes in and out over many years. And the number one thing, rather than to say have sex or a lot of sex or yes, sex is good, is learn to have a conversation about it so that people are not personalizing where the other person is at. It's the number one trouble couples bring to me around sex is not knowing how to talk about it, feeling so triggered or defensive that where they start to talk about it, it just, they go into shutdown or they go into trouble.
Right, right. Well, we need to take a quick break. I want to talk when we come back about the five stages of the love cycle with you.
Okay.
And obviously we're going to take a high level look at it because of time, but I think it's really interesting and definitely something we want to talk about today. So please do stay with us. We are talking with Linda Carroll. Her new book is called Love Cycles, The Five Essential Stages of Lasting Love. And Carol, is this is out in ebook right now, but it actually launches in paperback, I think, September.
No, it's out on Amazon and Barnes and Noble. It's out right now. You can get it.
Okay.
And you can go to lovecycles.org. There's a quiz that Pepper Schwartz, your wonderful local Pepper Schwartz, I'm sure she's been on the show. Pepper did the quiz for me, and you can do the quiz online.
Okay, great.
Shows you what cycle you're in.
All right. Well, thanks for clarifying that. Please stay with us. We'll be right back.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Did you know that capsizing boats and people falling overboard account for over 70% of boating fatalities? 80% of those fatalities occur on boats under 26 feet and on boats with operators who've had no formal boating instruction. 50% of all boating accidents involve alcohol. Be smart this summer. Know who you're boating with. Wear a Coast Guard approved life jacket and don't drink and boat. This message is brought to you by supporters of Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair and the JMB Group, who wish you safe boating fun.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you, at the exact level you need, whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
Hi, I'm Charlie. I fight fires and I save lives.
My name's Renee. I'm a cardiologist. I save lives.
My name's Anthony. I'm an EMT. I save lives.
You don't have to be a professional to save a life. Firefighters, doctors, and others save lives. You can too. Don't wait. To learn more about the warning signs and how you can help prevent suicide, visit save.org. In a crisis, call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-TALK.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Join us live every Monday at noon on Alternative Talk 1150 or stream live from conversationslive.net.
Independent programs, independent voices, independent ideas. Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
Oh, laid on, baby. I love that. Lay all your love on me. All right. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Thanks for being with us this hour. Appreciate you spending this time with us. My guest is Linda Carroll, and she's been a couples therapist for many, many years. And one of the things I really love about her work is that I feel this therapist... and the author has actually been in a real relationship. I was saying in the break, sometimes I've looked at them and, you know, decided to pass on the book for the show because I just feel that person's never been in a real relationship.
Right.
And I know you had a very specific reason for writing this book, Linda. So share that with us if you would.
I was on an airplane and there was a magazine someone left there and I started to look at it and it was a question and answer, you know, sort of a Dear Abby column, and someone wrote in and said, I don't think I'm in love with my partner anymore. And the person writing the column wrote back and said, well, then the relationship is probably over. And I just reading that put me in a state of feeling so outraged that that information was out there. And I thought, oh my gosh, how many times have I felt in love and not in love with my husband.
Mm-hmm.
And that is so destructive, that idea that when we come to the end of that free, wonderful, yummy, falling in love all the time, every moment stage, it's over. And I think what I really tapped into, Vicki, was my feeling that we have such a cultural trouble because we have a culture that really talks about stage one, which is the merge, as being what love is. And that is the falling in love part. It's not what love is. Love comes over many seasons. And the falling in love now, we know, is mediated by lots of chemicals. You know, there's all kinds of drugs and chemicals and changes in the brain when we fall in love, which is a whole fascinating thing in itself. I won't spend a lot of time on that, except that some of the research shows that when we fall in love, the part of the brain that lights up in that first stage, which is about 3 years and a little less every time we fall in love, is the same part that lights up with gambling. So there you are.
Interesting.
It's a dopamine hit, you know?
Yeah, it's a dopamine hit.
And that's why you don't need to eat or sleep and you become obsessed. And it's a very strong chemical, emotional attachment we feel to the object of that feeling, whatever that is, whether it's chocolate or gambling or another person, and often what we mistake the strength of that feeling for is the strength of the rightness that we should be with that person. And I say to people, you know, that's a big sign that says pay attention, but it doesn't mean move to Cleveland, have a baby, or or give up your life. It just means I've got a big attraction. But you've got to know who a person is when they don't get their own way,
right,
when, you know, they're disappointed.
Right.
There's so many different things that a long-term relationship is built on, and that feeling is probably going to go and come many times.
Right. And
go ahead.
We're in this giddy love stage. As you said, it's like being high on a drug, and we overlook all these red flags that we might see, you know, in a person if we weren't feeling that way about them. So love cycle number two, the second stage is doubt and denial. That presumably is when we start seeing, you know, the other side of them, when they're grumpy in the morning. And
right. Well, not just when they're grumpy, but the thing in the second stage, where the beginning of the power struggle happens, doubt and denial, the things we fell in love with start to annoy us. So it's not just when they're grumpy, it's those very qualities that we fell in love with, we start to see another side of it. You know, we fall in love with somebody who is so generous, they give money to everybody they see. And then we share a checkbook. And now it's not so much fun that they're giving money to everybody
right,
that they
right.
see. Right?
Right.
Or we fall in love with someone who's so predictable, and they say 5 o'clock and they're there at 5. And that's great, but that quality overdone becomes rigidity. And then we find out they're never willing to change on anything. So those qualities, we see the other side of it, and we start to have power struggles. We're wired for connection, and we're also wired for protection. And in the second stage, what happens is we start to realize that I'm not you and you're not me. And this unconditional word, which is a tricky word, boy, that we felt so at the beginning that we were unconditionally loving, we start to feel more conditional, and they're more conditional. We're less vulnerable. Our libido may go back down, and sex starts to feel normal rather than amazing, and you start something called infinity loops, which is a reoccurring conversation or fight people have over and over and over, which I get into a lot in the book, and I can, if we have time, I'll talk about that. People love to understand that. But then we move into disillusionment after a long period of time, and people, I want to say, go through this cycle very loud, some people, very dramatic, and for some people, it's very small. You don't see it. It's not huge. They're not necessarily dramatically in them, but I think it's pretty common for most people to go through these stages many times.
Mm-hmm.
Disillusionment is when we have the same argument over and over, and we start, and you know how you said in the first, we see only the best part of the other person?
Right.
It's like there's a veil that covers us. Well, in the third stage, we see only the worst. We see everything they do becomes evidence, even the shirt they're wearing, you know? Oh, you know, wouldn't you know he wore that shirt? It's like we're also in a trance. There's a veil over us there that stops us from seeing the good parts. Just like in stage one, we don't see the parts that are going to be trouble later on.
So this sounds like a self-protective strategy that we're adopting.
Yes.
We're taking it on, and we're projecting our fears and finding fault for the sake of finding fault, really.
Yeah, it is, but I think you're really right. It's a protective strategy. Now that person who was so safe has become unsafe. They're starting to criticize us. And we're starting to lose our belief that we've cracked the code, which we all feel when we fall in love. And so we're starting to protect ourselves. That's exactly right. And so we're just lining up what's wrong. One of the things I caution people in this stage, you know, often people will come into a therapist's office when they feel like the relationship is over because they're so disillusioned.
Mm.
And one of the things I say is, you know, maybe it is over, but this isn't the time to make the decision. If you can just work a little bit with what's going on, a lot of times people want out of the pain, not out of the relationship. And if you can get out of the pain, all those good things come back. So that stage three is anxiety and stress go up, and this other person is not just often the safest person in the world, but they become unsafe. We don't want to be around them.
Right.
And sex can disappear totally at this stage. Arguments increase, and people can stay in this for a long, long time. Something, though, propels them into a place where they feel, I have to make a decision. I can't do this any longer.
And that's stage four.
That's stage four, called decision. And there's four possibilities. One is to do nothing. And it's a frightening thought, but people can stay in unhappiness for their whole life. And that's one option. Another is to go into what I call parallel lives, where you have, you know, you can learn a lot. You can be kind to each other. You might share community or family life or work life or dog life, and you become hopefully caring roommates. And it's not bad. You know, for some people, that's an okay decision if they do it without feeling bitter or unhappy. That, you know, maybe some of the glamour has worn off and it's not what we thought, but we work out well together. But I think you can do that a lot better or a lot worse. You have to have a little awareness to have parallel lives work well, because we all want soulmates, but we're not going to all get soulmates.
Right,
the
right.
Third is to be able to leave the relationship as a third decision. And I think that to leave it consciously, you know, with kindness, and that, boy, that's a big call. But to have done your work, because if you don't know how you got into the trouble, you're going to go out and re-choose the same kind of person.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So trying to understand how you got to a place where you started with such high hopes and it fell so far is really important. And the fourth is choosing wholehearted love. How can we learn from what's going on? And how can we find the promise in that first stage? And that's really about skill. and intention. You know, the first stage, you get it free. It's like someone takes you on a helicopter on the top of a mountain, and it's fantastic. But the fifth stage, wholehearted, you got to walk up that mountain. You've got to go through all the different seasons and the trainings and the sore feet and the blisters to get to the top of the mountain. But when you get there, you have something. Now, the promised realized is marvelous. And what I think happens in that fifth stage is you don't get there. It's like enlightenment. You don't just land, and now we're here. You know, different stages of life bring in different challenges. So some people have many good years, and then they get older. One of them gets deaf. They start fighting about who said what. Different stages of life, different eras of our life bring in challenges, so we don't arrive. We're always moving, but I think what happens in the fifth stage, or I know this is what happens because I think I've been in it mostly, is that sometimes we fall in love with our partner all over again, mm-hmm. just like we did in the beginning. And then 3 hours later, we move into doubt and denial, and then they do something that irritates us, and we think, oh, my gosh, how could I have felt that for you last night? You know, you're still driving me crazy the way you drop your stuff everywhere. But we have some objectivity. We know that this is a season or a moment. It's not the end of love.
Right.
That
right.
love is a practice,
right.
and the better we get at it, the more we have of it.
Yes, love it, love it. And you share in the book Six Essential Skills, and I just want to talk about this one because I think it's critical, and it kind of fits into the wholehearted living too. And that is we are responsible ourselves, not our partner. We are responsible ourselves for sharing, for keeping our tank filled.
Yes, we
and
are.
You share a great story in the book about you and your husband and how he would like to go cycling after you'd done a workshop together, and you just wanted to sit and talk about it. And
it's absolutely true. You know, that's great. And that comes into the idea of you're not me. You know, we love is an inside job, and we really think it's about the other person, but it isn't. It's we're the ones that have to love from within ourselves. And if it's based on you making me feel good all the time, we're in trouble.
Right.
So, and part of how I keep it filled, my tank filled, is by doing the things that nourish me. You know, it's a very well-used cliche, but it's so good, about put your oxygen mask on first. If I've given up me to love you and to be with you, then I'm going to run out in my tank. So I've got to do things that start to fill and take care of me. When I talk about wholehearted love, there's two chapters on wholehearted love. One is barriers, because what gets in the way? If my heart, of having a half a heart or a closed down heart, that's my work, is to find out what it is in me that can't fully open to another person, or only can do it when things are going my way. And the part of keeping your own tank full is knowing that we have to feed the garden of our own well-being first of all,
right.
whatever that is.
Yeah. Linda, I want to ask you, in Love Cycles, when you're writing this, you know, many books have sample stories in there. They give, they might choose several couples and give their version of what happened as an example in the story, in the book, to illustrate a point. You take one couple through those whole five stages.
Yes.
So talk to us a little about that, if you would.
Well, it was a really great experience to do. It was interesting. I started out just trying to give an example of a couple in stage one. Megan and Charlie, and I give lots of examples in the book of lots of different kinds of people, but they were very strong, and they started to get real for me. And when I wrote the second stage, doubt and denial and the struggle, I saw them. I thought, well, why not continue with them? And I didn't really have a plan to bring them through the book, but somehow they kept coming up. And one of the funny things that happened was when I got to disillusionment, I knew there had to be some big trouble in the relationship. And, you know, all of my examples are based on lots of different people, not one couple in particular. So I can't say this was really about anybody, but I knew what I thought the trouble should be. And when I went to write it, it's almost like they became real characters and wouldn't let me, and changed it all from how I thought it was. I was sitting in this very room starting to write about the big mess they got into, and these characters almost appeared and said, no, it wasn't that way. And suddenly they were with me forever. I went all the way through the book with them. In fact, there's a chapter about them, just about them, as they going to come.
Right.
I'm not going to tell
right.
you the story, but
right. Right.
So yeah, that I don't think I've ever read a book where it had one couple showing all of the different examples of all the different stages.
No, I haven't either. And you know, we've just got about 3 minutes left here, but I wanted to just go back to something you mentioned, and that was infinity loops. If you can just give us a high level look at what you meant by those infinity loops.
Okay, very quickly. When we feel, when a part, let's see, how can I say this? When you, as soon as you said quickly, my brain slowed down.
it's fine. Okay.
We know,
it's, do it slowly, Linda. Do it slowly.
That this isn't true, of course, for all men or all women. But we know that for most women, the number one fear is disconnection. And for men, statistically, the number one fear is feeling criticized. And we have particular ways we respond to trouble. We either go to fight, freeze, or flee. So let's say that I fit in this category, and let's say that I want connection, and when I don't get it, I become critical. So I go to my husband, I say, how are you? He's reading the paper, he says, I'm busy. I start to criticize him as a way to get closer, which is crazy in itself. He feels criticized, which is his main trigger, and he withdraws. The more he withdraws, the more I feel abandoned or disconnected, so the more I go after him. So what's wrong, I say. Nothing's wrong, he says. And so then we start this loop until finally I say, well, what's wrong? And he says, now there is something wrong. But it didn't start out with anything wrong. It started out because my need, which was for connection, got right in the way of his need, which was for solitude. And then my way of reacting to that triggered his deepest vulnerability, which was to feel criticized. Mm-hmm. So round we go, and we never break out of those until we understand them. And then it's marvelous. You can even learn to laugh about them.
Right. Well, I think it's a well-written book. And I, as I said earlier, I think this is written by not just a therapist, but a therapist who's had a real relationship, because
yes,
that makes all the difference.
Yes.
And I want to, Linda, thank you so much for being with us. I really do appreciate your time. I'm going to let listeners know that you're coming to Third Place Books actually in October the 23rd at 7, October 23rd at 7 p.m. But I will remind listeners that the week before you arrive here, so that if they want to come see you, they can.
Oh, thank you, Vicky. That's great.
And
thanks for having me on the program.
My pleasure. My pleasure. And the book, again, is called Love Cycles, The Five Essential Stages of Lasting Love. And that is available right now. Love Cycles, The Five Essential Stages of Lasting Love. And the best website to go find out more about is at, I wrote it down, it's lovecycles.org. And the quiz is up there. You can go find which phase of the relationship you are in, if you're interested. All right, please do stay with us. We will be back with Alison Lurie, Pulitzer Prize winner, and she has a new book out called The Language of Houses. You are listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Did you know that capsizing boats and people falling overboard account for over 70% of boating fatalities? 80% of those fatalities occur on boats under 26 feet and on boats with operators who've had no formal boating instruction. 50% of all boating accidents involve alcohol. Be smart this summer. Know who you're boating with. Wear a Coast Guard approved life jacket and don't drink and boat. This message is brought to you by supporters of Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair and the JMB Group, who wish you safe boating fun.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to animal communicator Darcy Pariso, we cover the world of animals. This week, August 31st, it's the last Sunday of the month, and that means it's a shelter, rescue, sanctuary, and anything that helps our animal friends Sunday. Kathy and Christy will host a show for me. Together, they'll check in with our bird and horse rescue and sanctuary regulars. Plus, they'll have new stuff and great interviews. Join them for the fun. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
If you'd like to advertise your business or service on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, or you'd like to become a program supporter by sponsoring one of our shows, please call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine a spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772 or email info@conversationslive.net.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Find out about upcoming shows at conversationslive.net.
There's nothing else like it on the dial. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And we're talking about relationships today, and we're going to continue the conversation, but in a slightly different vein. We're going to look at the relationships between houses. The book is called The Language of Houses, How Buildings Speak to Us. And who better to write this than Alison Lurie? She's the winner of the Pulitzer Prize. She's the author of 10 novels. And three of her novels have been adapted for television. So she's been writing for many, many years. She's received numerous honors, including the Guggenheim and Rockefeller Foundation grants, the American Academy of Arts and Letters Award in fiction, and a D.Lit from Oxford University. And she's a member of the American Academy of Arts and Letters and American Academy of Arts and Sciences. And she's taught literature, folklore, humor, and writing at Cornell University since 1969 and is now the Frederick J. Whitten Professor of American Literature. Alison Lurie, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
And you've been writing a long, long, long time. You make no secret of your age. It's right there on your website.
That's right.
No plans to retire there.
Oh, I am retired. That's why it says emerita. That means I've been retired for about 5 years.
But you're still writing. You're still writing.
Oh, yes.
I don't think writers ever retire.
If they do retire, they become very unhappy. I've noticed.
Right.
Restless, you know.
Yes, I think.
And then they start telling stories at dinner parties.
Well, I was at a screenwriters conference in Los Angeles many years ago, over 20 years ago now, and the person who was facilitating the course had written for MASH, the movie, and Kojak, the series, all those good old shows. He was, getting on in years himself. And he said that, he wrote on the blackboard, being a writer is like having homework for the rest of your life. You can never switch off.
No.
You're always eavesdropping,
like,
or researching or looking for new story ideas.
Yeah, but it's not homework. It's fun.
Yeah. Well, he was kind of tongue-in-cheek on that.
Yeah.
So you've written an extraordinary amount and on a wide different of subjects. And in 1981, you published a book on clothes, exploring history, social status, individual psychology. And then you wrote many books in between that. You've now written this book, The Language of Houses, How Buildings Speak to Us. And as the title suggests, it looks at the structure of buildings, how they're made, the spaces with them, who lives in them. What fascinated you enough about this subject to write a book about it?
Oh, well, I've always been interested in how the world around me looks. And I realized when I wrote the book about clothes, people said to me, well, why don't you do one about houses? But I had a novel in mind, so I just forgot about it. And then I had a moment when I didn't have a novel in mind, so I went back to it, and I realized that that I've been making assumptions about buildings and having ideas about them. And what's more, that we all have. When I began to do the research, I hired some students to interview other students and interview people back home in their hometowns and show them pictures of buildings and houses and ask them what they thought. And I thought, well, maybe this won't work, though. They're young kids. They're not interested, really, in how a room looks. But no, they were absolutely full of ideas.
Yeah.
Well,
you say...
I showed them the same contemporary colonial house painted six different colors, and they all loved the white one, and they kind of liked the yellow one and the tan one, but they couldn't stand the green one or the purple one. So it was fun to do this.
Right. Well, you say that public houses in general speak to us. Our homes, on the other hand, speak for us. So if we were to see your home, tell us what your house would say about you. How would it speak for you?
Well, that's harder, of course. I think it would say that I'm someone who has rather traditional tastes. This is not a modern house. There are no acres of glass. There's no swimming pool. There's no kitchen with granite tops and a central island that you keep bumping into as you walk around. It's a house that you can't even see the television because it's hidden in a cabinet. And it's full of things that have meaning for us. I mean, it has paintings, a couple of paintings that my parents owned, and it has things we picked up when my husband was a Fulbright scholar in India, and so on. So you know that we traveled, and you know that we loved to read because we're almost being edged out of our house by the number of books we have here.
I know that feeling.
Yeah.
So you took the time and trouble to look up a couple of buildings locally, and one of them was Union Station down in Tacoma, which of course now is the courthouse. Well, we're going to take a very quick break. When we come back, I'd like to ask you, you know, your opinion of that and what you have to share with us about that. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and we are talking with Alison Lurie. She's the author of The Language of Houses, How Buildings Speak to Us. Please stay with us. We'll be right back.
Father wears his Sunday best. Mother's tired, she needs a rest. The kids are playing up downstairs. Sister's sighing in her sleep. Brother's got a date to keep. He can't hang around.
If you love dogs, tune in to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, live every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. We'll talk about everything dog and interview authors, experts, and amazing organizations, both locally and nationally. And don't even get me started on the pet food industry. I'm Julie Forbes. Find us online at www.dogradioshow.com and also as a free podcast on iTunes. The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, an evolved perspective on life with dogs.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicky St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health,
self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you at the exact level you need. Whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Don't forget, this is Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
In the middle of our street, our house. In the middle of our street, our house.
And welcome back, everyone. You are listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And we are talking about the language of houses in this segment. We're talking about how buildings speak to us. And my guest says that public buildings speak to us, but our houses speak for us. And one of the things that Alison did, Alison Lurie, of course, is Pulitzer Prize winner, and she wrote this book. She took the time to look up some local buildings around here, picked a couple of buildings from Tacoma. We're going to talk about those right now. And the first one is Union Station, which is now our courthouse down in Tacoma. Tell us your take on that, Alison.
Well, it's a very impressive, original building. I mean, it's got this arch and dome, and this widespread. So it's impressive. It's traditional, but it's also imaginative. And I can see through the big front arch the hanging bubbles that I now have learned are worked by your famous local glass artist, Cholula.
Yeah, Dale Cholula. Thanks, Eric, for that, because I didn't know that.
And it's a kind of magical look, and it's a little bit like the stadium, which also is a big dome, and I can see its picture now. It looks to me like it might be a flying saucer that landed recently, because the aliens were interested in Mount Rainier, which is looming over it.
So we're talking about the Tacoma Dome right now.
The Tacoma Dome, your stadium. And also, I read that you have concerts with famous stars, and as well as basketball and hockey.
You do?
Like Mount Rainier, it's big, it's white, it's beautiful, it's larger than life.
Yeah. What about the school there? Is it called the Stadium School? Eric probably knows better.
Stadium High School.
I don't know.
Stadium High School. You mentioned that, Alison.
Tacoma High School.
Yeah.
It's a red brick building. It looks like a cross between a castle and a church. And it's a very strong looking. Its message is both that education is spiritual, and that education will protect you as well as inspire you.
It is quite an impressive building, and it's high up as well, so it overlooks a lot of the port, the area.
I didn't know. I can't tell that, though.
Yeah, from the picture.
There are, of course, steps up to the entrance, but buildings that we're meant to admire and be inspired by are very often lifted off the ground level by a flight of steps, and as if to tell us that this is something above you, higher than you. Art museums do it a lot, for instance.
Yeah. Interesting. You know, you talk about all kinds of buildings, restaurants, hospitals, prisons. Did you actually go, how did you do your research? Did you go into those buildings?
Well, I tried to go into as many as I could, locally, and then when I went somewhere to visit or speak, I do the same. Of course, there are buildings I had difficulty going into, and I realized, for instance, was very hard for me to go into some certain kinds of bars. And I realized that if a bar has a neon sign in the window advertising a certain sort of beer, it's a sign for a single woman to stay out unless she's there for some, some commercial purpose.
So you didn't want to take a risk on that, huh?
Well, I looked into a couple, but the stares that the bartender and the patrons gave me were very uncomfortable. Whereas a woman can go alone into a coffee shop and nobody's going to notice, and you can, and a woman can go into a bar as long as she's got a guy with her too.
Right. So you talk about materials that we use, and of course, where I grew up in England at home, you know, almost everybody lives in a brick house. It's very rare you don't have a brick house. My sister did at one time live in a farmhouse cottage, which was many, well, hundreds of years old, and that was built with stone. But what does the material tell us? What does it mean if you see a brick house? How do you interpret that?
Well, it really depends almost entirely on what the local building materials are. In the South, in parts of the South and parts of the Midwest where there just aren't very many trees, people built with brick and stone. In New England where the fields were full of stones, they built with stone, stone walls, stone houses, stone churches. When you have lots of trees, you build with wood.
Right.
If you build with stone in an area where stones are expensive and hard to get, then you're making a statement of some kind.
Right. I was in Norway, probably 4 years ago now, and I took a tour, and one of the things, most of the houses there are made of wood, and they have very steep, sharp roofs, very high, steep, sharp roofs, because
yes.
of all the snow they get, they want it to fall off. And
that's
so
right.
the tour guide said that you could tell in the olden days, 100 years or so ago, you could tell who was wealthy and who was not by the way the planks were. If the planks went up vertically, that meant they were rich. If the house was built with horizontal planks, they weren't so rich, or they could have just been more money conscious. And the reason they did that was because the planks often had to be replaced because of the bad weather, the ice, the snow, flooding. And, the vertical one, they'd have to replace many planks and, that went way up to the roof. And the horizontal ones, they could just pull out the ones that had gone rotten. So I thought that was kind of interesting. It was a
thought of that.
Yeah, that's it was a status symbol.
That's very interesting. You very seldom see vertical planks around here.
House has vertical planks, actually, strangely enough.
Yes.
It also has a little brick.
Yeah. Well, I think it's more elegant, just as a dress with vertical stripes makes us look better than one with horizontal stripes.
That's it. So I want to ask you, you've been around a long, long time, had some great experiences, Pulitzer Prize winner, you've won many, many awards and accolades for your work. What does Alison at this age wish that Alison at maybe 30 years old knew back then?
Well, when I was 30 years old, I hadn't been able to publish anything for 10 years because I began in college publishing stories and a little poetry even, and then I decided I wanted to be a novelist, and I wrote two novels that I couldn't get published. Now I thank God that I didn't get these novels published, but then it made me absolutely miserable. What I wish I had known then was that I was going to be published and I should go on writing, whereas a lot of my friends felt sorry for me and their attitude was, the poor girl, why doesn't she just quit and enjoy her family?
Well, I think you have a birthday coming up soon, right? Next month?
That's right.
Well, do you want to tell listeners how old you are?
I will be 88.
Well, congratulations. We wish you a wonderful birthday, Allison, and I really appreciate you being with us to share your latest work with us today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
And the book, again, is called The Language of Houses, How Buildings Speak to Us, published by HarperCollins and, Delphinium Books. And that's available right now, The Language of Houses, How Buildings Speak to Us. And you can find out more about Allison and her work at AllisonLurie.com, and that's spelled L-U-R-I-E. All right, that's about it for today. I want to thank you each for being with us today. Really appreciate you spending this time with us. And we'll be back after Labor Day. We're going to take a little break next week, but we'll have a great show lined up for you. And you can find me if you have questions or comments, feedback on today's show. You can find me at info@conversationslive.net. You can also find me at 800-495-7617. And very quickly, I also launched my new blog. It's called BB's Beat. It's only got a little bit up there right now, but we've got tons of articles coming on that soon. BB'sBeat.com. See you soon. Have a great Labor Day weekend. Thanks for being with us. Live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.